If you've lived for any great length of time near a beach, you may likely see what coastal geologists have told us for years. Hawaii's beaches are disappearing. Erosion, sea level rise, and the effect of human interaction and misuse are some of the reasons. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and today on Town Square, we'll talk with researchers who have been documenting the changes and who are making the case that if Hawaii wants to continue to have beautiful beaches to enjoy, it's going to have to adequately fund the actions to maintain them. Joining me today are Chip Fletcher, Brad Romine, and Dolan Eversole. Chip Fletcher is the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Geology and Geophysics in the UH School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology. He conducts research and trains undergraduate and graduate students in paleoclimatology, sea level impacts, and coastal processes. Brad Romine is a coastal geologist and coastal management specialist with the UH Sea Grant College Program. He also works with the State of Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. His role is to bridge the gap between the university and Hawaii's communities to improve coastal management and hazards resilience. He also earned his master's and PhD degrees in geology and geophysics from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Dolan Eversole is the Waikiki Management Coordinator through the UH Sea Grant College Program and the Waikiki Beach Special Improvement District Association. He previously served as the Pacific Islands Regional Coordinator for NOAA's Coastal Storms Program and worked with U.S.-affiliated Pacific Island territories to reduce their vulnerability through measures that improve adaptation and community resilience. And of course, you're here too. And if you'd like to be part of the discussion, you can call us at 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, please use that number. Or if you call us from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream elsewhere, you can reach us at 877-941-3689. Welcome to all of you, and thanks very much for the time.
Aloha. Aloha. Thanks for having us on.
You all deal with this every single day and have for years in both studies and in practice. For the rest of us, most of what we hear about beach erosion happens when we see a news item. I'd like to sort of, you know, pull back the lens a little bit and have each of you talk a little about what you see when you look at Hawaii, and not just necessarily Waikiki, although, you know, clearly you have some specialty a viewpoint of that, Dolan, but to have a viewer of what we see when you look around the islands through your eyes. And Chip, I'll start with you.
Well, what I see are a lot of beautiful beaches. We have a gorgeous coastline. We have beautiful beaches. Looking a little bit at them from a more practical point of view, it's clear that in too many places we have developed the coastline right up to the edge of these beaches. And we know that sea level is rising. There is wide agreement among scientists who specialize in this field that sea level is going to accelerate. In fact, we also know that today global sea level is rising at three times the rate that it did in the 20th century. And we're at the very beginning of what will likely be an exponential rise in sea level. And so if a beach is defined as an ecosystem at the edge of the ocean, and the ocean is rising, that beach needs to move. It needs to migrate landward as the ocean expands, and the shoreline needs to expand with it. Unfortunately, we've put a lot of permanent development in the form of coastal highways and coastal communities in the way of that expansion, and so there is a slow-motion collision taking place on our shorelines.
Brad?
Just to back up what Chip said with some of the studies we've done, we've looked at the historical trends of shoreline change around the islands, looking at aerial photographs and old maps, going back to the earlier part of the 1900s. And we have data. We understand. We know that there is a widespread erosion problem here in Hawaii. It's cleared from the news reports that come out on a monthly basis. But we also know long term, about 70% of our beaches on Kauai, Oahu, and Maui are eroding. It gets a little more complicated when you look at the individual beaches. There can be real localized hotspots of erosion or even accretion in some localized areas. The rates of erosion actually vary from one island to another. They're substantially higher on Maui. About 85% of beaches on Maui are eroding, and we're experiencing real acute erosion problems, in particular along the West Maui coastline, the resort areas of Ka'anapali, Kahana, North Maui as well. But you know, widespread. My work with the DLNR, we're often the front line, the first people that get a phone call if somebody's having an erosion problem, if their home is threatened. So it's this problem of coastal erosion as well as coastal flooding is not something necessarily, you know, off in the future. We're dealing with these issues of sea level rise and coastal erosion now. It's a real problem, a real chronic problem for us.
And clearly it's a chronic problem in Waikiki because we've already been through that drill a couple of times. Dolan, as you look at Waikiki and you want to bring a fuller conversation to how we regard Waikiki, how do you do that when people just see certain parts of it or they just hear news items about they're going to be moving in sand or it needs more sand or some of the things that if you've lived here for a while, you've already seen?
We talk about Waikiki almost daily now with the erosion going on, beach management projects, land use and development. And I think it's important to recognize that Waikiki is a very unique place. The beach itself is largely a man-made structure. It's full of an engineering history. And I've heard sentiment off and on that, you know, we should just let the beaches be natural in Waikiki and let the shoreline go where it needs to go. I would generally agree with that, but Waikiki is a bit of an exception, I think, to this conservation principle of, you know, migrating shorelines. To be perfectly honest, I don't think the community and stakeholders of Waikiki have quite got their mind around the idea of retreat, managed retreat from the shoreline, although the reality is we're going to have to start to talk about that in the coming years. But one of the things I did want to touch on hearing from Chip and Brad is I think it's important to recognize that we live in a very informed world now, and we have a lot of information available to us. And I know Chip and I both have been doing talks on climate change for over a decade now. And when we first started doing these talks, there was always a small portion of the crowd that would kind of have their hands crossed in the back of the room, kind of frowning, and the skeptics, I guess. And I think for the most part, from my perspective, that is not really, I don't really see that much anymore. And the conversation has changed from, you know, 5-10 years ago, the question was, so what? We would talk about things like sea level rise and we'd hear, so what? The question now is, so now what? And that one word changes the context completely. And I think we have a lot of information available to us. We're struggling now as a state and a nation, for that matter, to try to incorporate that data into land use policies and development. So that's the next stage of the active research going on, is to find ways to apply that to how we live and build along the coast.
We also have an additional driver because we're not just talking about trying to maintain beaches so we can all go out and enjoy them and live in a lovely state. We also have an economic driver. People come here specifically for beaches, especially for Waikiki. Just to give everybody sort of a bit of history, you mentioned that it's a man-made beach. Many people know that. But in terms of how it looks now compared to how it looked historically and how things have changed, I think that'd be worth a little time.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to give a quick overview of that. When you look at the south shore of Oahu, from the Pearl Harbor area all the way through Waikiki, it's almost entirely a function of human intervention of some form. You know, you have the reef runway, just an entirely man-made geographic feature that you can see from satellite imagery. Honolulu Harbor has been largely seawalled. Sand Island, most people don't realize Sand Island is largely man-made. It was a very small sand spit before it was filled with dredge material from the harbor. And then as we go down the coast, there's just more of the same with seawalls and shoreline structures. And then we get into the history of Waikiki, which in itself is fascinating. There's a long history of shoreline development and subsequent armoring to protect properties. And what a lot of people don't realize, however, is in the case of Waikiki at least, none of it was really planned out in a comprehensive way. And what we're left with is a result of ad hoc shoreline construction, seawalls and groins and different structures that one was built without really much thought about how that impacts the adjacent beach. As a result, 10, 20 years later, they build another portion. And a perfect example of this is the Cujillo Beach area. Most people are familiar with the two swim basins there with a partially submerged breakwater, commonly known as the crib wall or the slippery wall. That was never really planned out as an entire structure. There was pieces of it that were built over 50 years, and we're left now with what's kind of a hodgepodge of pseudo-engineered structures, some of which works okay, other portions of it don't work very well. So there, if you look at the history of Waikiki, it didn't look anything like it does now. It's an entirely man-made structure, and the beach itself has been, you know, sand has been brought in from elsewhere. So we're looking at working with the university and the DLNR on developing new comprehensive plans for Waikiki.
We're going to talk more about beach erosion around the state in Waikiki, maybe even at your beach. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We want to hear from you, too. Have you been watching your beach erode? And are you involved in efforts to stem that erosion? Do you even understand why it's happening? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Brad, we just heard what Dolan had to say about Waikiki, but there are other areas around the state. I'm thinking of Kaanapali, where, you know, that's also been aided and abetted by a lot of human interest. Mm-hmm. How did that look once upon a time? And given the changes that we've been seeing in the very recent years, how has that been developing?
Well, the area of North Kaanapali is heavily armored, and there's been a lot of beach loss in that area going north from Honokuvai Point. The southern area of Kaanapali still maintains, for the most part, a really nice natural beach in front of the hotels in those areas. But there has been some chronic erosion, particularly at the very southern end of Kaanapali, fronting the Hyatt Hotel in particular. We've had quite a bit of beach erosion. It's really seemed to have accelerated in the last 10 years or so and is starting to affect the beach walk that runs between among all the in front of all the hotels in that area, is an important connector for the foot traffic and the business in that area, and is now starting to erode back into the beach walk at the south there. So the state is currently working in a partnership. The state has done a number of these partnerships with Waikiki folks, the hotels there. We're now involved also with the Kaanapali Operators Association to investigate options for beach restoration at Kaanapali, particularly in the southern area where that area is eroded. And like Waikiki, we have these multi-story, you know, very large resort buildings on the shoreline that are affected. But these businesses do rely on this very beautiful beach in front of there, too. And so looking forward, you know, beach restoration is one of the options we're pursuing for that area. But it's expensive, and it comes with real logistical as well as environmental challenges. So it seems to make sense in the area where there's a lot of money coming in, like Waikiki or Kaanapali. It remains a bit of a question mark for other more less urbanized areas, whether beach restoration will be an option going forward. And it kind of begs the question then, if not beach restoration, what? You know, we don't have a lot of sand available, so it requires us to look at other options for a lot of these areas also.
And as Chip mentioned when we talked a little earlier in the week, sand isn't sand. You have to have the right kind of sand to be able to bring in to a beach.
That's one of the real challenges is finding sand. There's little or no resources left on land that we can mine for beach restoration. We're really forced to go offshore like we did for the Waikiki Restoration Project in 2012, dredging, pumping sand from small pockets and channels of sand offshore. And it's a real engineering and logistical challenge on our reef environments.
And the sand that you need to put on the beach has to be scaled to that beach, literally the size of the grain, the sand grain itself. If it's too small, it's not going to stay on the beach. You spent all this money, and the beach will erode, you know, extremely quickly. If it's too coarse, it's not going to be properly scaled to what the natural ecosystem is, and it might also in its own way be more easily eroded. So you need to sample the native beach. You need to then find a sand source that has the same statistical characteristics as the native beach. And this is not as easy to do as one might think. There's not that much sand offshore. As Brad says, the onshore sand resources are really no longer available. So also just working in the marine environment, working under the ocean, you're limited in terms of access. The logistics are very expensive, and finding sand to put on your beach becomes very problematic.
When we spoke a little earlier in the week when you were on the conversation, you also made the point that those who are very concerned about sand being moved from Maui to other islands, this is not sand that's going into a beach. And we've had several callers, and I'm going to just have the question answered for all of you so you don't have to wait in line. But looking at the idea that you can't just take sand that might be used for creating concrete or something else and plop it on a beach.
That's right. In fact, a lot of the Maui sand is dune sand. Much of it has been used as burial sites in the past. Some of it is sort of contaminated with soil and dirt. The sand that is taken there today is used by the cement industry as an aggregate. In fact, sand is so limited in Hawaii that I know some aggregate companies or cement companies are actually shipping in sand from British Columbia to use in our concrete production. So I know it's controversial on Maui, the fact that sand is mined and taken elsewhere.
But it's not winding up on our beaches, right?
It's not.
We had a comment from someone who is a shy caller wanting to know, is there any future or any hope about making sand from recycled glass?
Well, I've heard that question before. I don't know that glass sand grains can be produced in enough quantity. You know, there were something like 17 to 20,000 cubic yards of sand put on Waikiki Beach in 2012. I don't know that we can grind up enough glass to do it. Number two,
where?
You know, where will you get the glass, right?
No, where do you get glass in that volume, and where are you able to process it in Hawaii? I mean, we don't have a recycling
facility. Right. And then number two, will glass sand grains function in a beach environment? Will they hold the slope that you need to make a beach, or will they simply slough down and collapse down onto the seafloor, in which case you've contaminated the seafloor? And how will glass grains, even though they're inert, how will glass grains interact with the ecosystem in the nearshore area?
So I hear all of you saying, we have a heck of a problem here. It's not going to go away. And we're all very much dependent upon its outcome, not just because we enjoy beaches, but because Waikiki, Kaanapali, other places around the state, we're talking tourism too. How much does tourism actually enter into this conversation?
Yeah, I don't mind taking that. I think it's a really crucial role for how we manage urban beaches. And it's important to distinguish urban beaches from rural beaches.
It sounds funny even to say urban beaches.
Yeah, it sounds like a strange term, but we use that term as needed when you have an urban environment with a beach fronting it. And Waikiki is a perfect example of an urban beach. We're not the only place that has urban beaches, and you might have unique management strategies for urban beaches that you wouldn't necessarily consider in a more rural setting. And one example of that is just a consistent beach nourishment program for a place like Waikiki. And as we've heard, we do have challenges with finding adequate sediment to put on the beach in Waikiki. Kind of reflecting back on the history of Waikiki just briefly, there's been a tremendous volume of sand brought into Waikiki Beach from other places and all over the state, primarily from Oahu, from different beaches. Back in the day, they used to just take sand from one beach and bring it to another. Well, we clearly can't do that anymore. But Waikiki is largely a composite of sand from all over, including Molokai, Waimanalo, the North Shore, Nanakuli. So we have this strange composite of sand. We heard from Chip that you try to match sand grains to the size of the existing beach. That's an additional challenge for Waikiki because it is not a natural beach to begin with, and it's this composite of sand from all over. But getting back to the question of the tourism, Waikiki has tremendous economic, social, and cultural value to our communities, to our visitor industry. As a matter of fact, there was a 2008 study that suggested the beach in Waikiki generates about $2 billion a year. That's $2 billion with a B. And so I think most people would agree Waikiki Beach is extremely valuable economically. Now that we have some figures to put towards that, it starts to add weight to investigating alternative management strategies. We're actually in the process of updating that economic study now at the University of Hawaii to try to understand what that dollar figure is in 2016 dollars. So we're about to release that in the next couple months.
Which means we'll have another conversation about it. Brad, jump in.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about our urban beaches. Of course, those are very important to our visitor industry. But, you know, our beaches in our less developed areas are suffering as well. And case in point being the North Shore of Oahu. That got a lot of press over the last few years with erosion in the Sunset Beach area. And we could really use more information on the value of those beaches to our economy, to our local communities. But in a large sense, some of these beaches are invaluable to our culture and society. And options like beach nourishment, beach restoration, really probably aren't feasible in a place like the North Shore that has such dynamic shorelines, huge waves every year. So there and elsewhere, we really are going to have to start talking about other options if we want to preserve these iconic beaches for our local community in the future.
I want to talk to you about what some of those are. Just want to remind you that today on Town Square, we're talking about beaches eroding around the state, maybe one that's in your neighborhood. We want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And beyond noticing that they're eroding, the question is, what are we going to do about it, and are we willing to spend the money for those ongoing actions? Our number is 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu, or 877-941-3689. My guests are Chip Fletcher, Dolan Eversole, and Brad Romine, and you.
Brad brings up a very good point about the North Shore of Oahu. We have Sunset Beach up there, which I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with. Sunset is a beautiful beach. It's extremely important economically, culturally, and environmentally. It's also eroding in many places, and we have a study going on at the university where we have identified on the order of 18 individual homes or buildings today that qualify for an emergency permit. Now, an emergency permit may mean many things, and it doesn't, even though you qualify for one, and the qualification means that you're close enough to an erosion threat that you viewed by planning departments as qualifying. But in many cases, an emergency permit can lead to a seawall. And we know from many studies that where seawalls are built on eroding shorelines or retreating shorelines, the beach narrows and eventually disappears. So if we raise 1 foot of sea level, our study shows, that jumps from 18 homes to 109 homes. And we're up to 60% of the beachfront property on Sunset Beach. 1 foot of sea level rise could potentially occur by mid-century, according to a recent report by NOAA. Are we willing to stand by and allow home after home put up seawalls and watch the slow death by a thousand strokes demise of Sunset Beach? And this problem, this challenge has been before the Hawaii community for decades now. We've done a lot in terms of trying to avoid seawall construction, but it is still going on. And we have not yet engaged in the question of what do we do with beachfront houses that are being attacked by erosion. What sort of exit strategy can we put together as a community, as a county, as a state? What sort of exit strategy can we put together for these communities that have themselves in a very tough situation and preserve the beach?
And that's some of what we're asking you today, too. You're in these communities. You're seeing this happen. And today you guys have been a little bit quiet. It's a big and scary problem to have to deal with, but it's one that's not going to go away. The question is, what's your part in it? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Jim calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Jim, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted, for like the other listeners, I don't know if people realize that I don't know what years it was, maybe the 20s or something, when there was a railroad around Kaino Point, North Shore. But Laniakea Beach, you know, where it's up, it used to go out to where everybody surfs. And the jump rock at Waimea was only halfway across the beach at one point. And they took all that sand, from what I understand, to fill in Waikiki so they could build houses on it, because that was all taro fields and stuff like that, you know, taro patches. But, you know, just an example of how we abuse that poor island.
All right, Jim. Thanks very much. I mean, many people have stories about what things look like and the times in which they were little kids or where their grandparents were here and family photos and, yeah, lots of issues like that.
Sand,
what do you do?
Sand mining took place on many, many beaches. It was used for construction. It was used to put on sugarcane fields. The calcium carbonate of our beach sand was used as fertilizer. And, in fact, there are old air photographs from the 40s, 50s, and 60s which show dragline operations and tractor tracks on our beaches, both at Waimea and up in Kahuku and other areas. And this was a big problem around Maui as well. That sand has been mined for years, but it's now illegal, and thank goodness it's not going on anymore.
But with the stories that everybody tells and shares among families, I mean, we can go on for hours and days talking about this stuff, but the fact that it's not going to change, and it's not going to change unless we take action, and the actions are going to be costly. You've all said that several times. Hey, it's not going to be inexpensive. It's going to be an expensive proposition, and we have to get our minds around that. You talk about, would we have to relocate people whose homes may be threatened? What will communities elect to do? At what point will they elect to do it, waiting until, you know, the 11th hour or taking precautions? We tend not to be really proactive about a lot of things. You all have been dealing with this for a very, very long time. Those of you listening, how about you? What do you think about what's happening in your communities if beaches are eroding, if you have a house on the beach, if you're watching shorelines that have been hardened and clearly change is happening? How much are you willing to do now? Or are you just going to sit around and wait until maybe later on when you really have to, or if you just simply lose some of your property? Maybe it will happen in someone's lifetime. Maybe it won't. The question still remains, what are communities going to do? So as I look at all of you, and you've talked about problems around the state, is there movement that you see in communities where they're willing to take this on, as opposed to those who just kind of think this is too much of a headache later?
I can address that. We
Brad?
Through the DLNR and Dolan's work and others, we've worked with some communities. One comes to mind on the north shore of Maui, the Stables Road, Sprecklesville area. There's a small community there of homeowners that came together that were having a severe erosion problem. Their homes were threatened, and they came together, formed a nonprofit, pooled their resources, worked with the state to develop a plan to restore their beach. In this case, it included pumping in a small amount of sand from offshore and building some small rock structures, rock groins. These are shore perpendicular structures to help stabilize the sand. And that's been a real successful project. We've been monitoring that project through regular surveys of the beach, and provides a nice model for folks if they can come together. And one of the challenges for the government agencies is that we, in a lot of ways, are forced to address these problems on a property-by-property basis, and it becomes reactionary, where we're trying to address the problem when it's already very critical. And
well, that's the whole point about, you know, are people going to really be proactive if this is coming down the pike? I mean, look at how we talk about climate change, too, and how much, as you talked about a little earlier, Dolan, trying to get people to understand certain things that you were talking about and regarding with great skepticism 10 years ago, looking at very differently now, knowing that there has to be some maybe time for people to get used to that. Mm-hmm. But you're also talking about something that's going to be an expense. The community that you're talking about, what was the dollar figure that they had to spend to protect their homes and bring in more sand?
I don't recall offhand, but you know, even a small project like that can be in the, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars.
And people hear that and they shake their head and say, we don't have that kind of money. How are we going to do that?
Well, the fact of the matter is it's going to be expensive no matter what. If they were able to get, as an alternative, permits for a large seawall or rock structure, you know, along the shoreline, that's very expensive as well. So there's no cheap alternatives, and we're working really hard to, with the community to try to develop options that are, you know, helping to protect the homes and development on land, while also trying to maintain the public access and the beaches in front of these houses. And beaches in a healthy state are one of the best protections you can have for, you know, the landward development. They're very efficient at absorbing wave energy. As long as they're in a healthy state, when they start retreating, then we have problems.
Which is kind of where we are now. Before, Chip, do you want to just jump in briefly? Because we've got callers on the line who want to talk to you guys.
Go ahead with the callers.
Okay. All right. We've got Jack calling us from Mililani. Aloha, Jack. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I used to live on Keiki Beach, which is the beach just north of Shark's Cove. And in the summertime, that beach would be about 150 yards from the compound that I lived in out to the water. And in the wintertime, the level would drop down about 30 or 40 feet. There were huge boulders exposed. And then in the summertime, all the sand would come back again.
So you're saying, what about some normal seasonal changes, and what's normal and seasonal and what's not?
That's one reason why studying beaches through time is difficult, because beaches are, we call them noisy. There's a big noise to them. Season to season, they fluctuate dramatically, and extracting a long-term trend, is Keiki Beach eroding, or is it accreting, or is it stable? When the signal-to-noise ratio is so difficult to extract like that, it's a problem. So we have a lot of beaches where we're not exactly sure what the long-term trend is. I did want to point out, though, that the state currently has a committee, a legislatively mandated committee called the Interagency Climate Adaptation Committee. And for 3 years, they've been studying the problem of sea level rise, and certainly beach erosion is a big part of the problem. At the end of this calendar year, a report will be coming out with ideas that need to be considered by the community, including the state legislature, for how we might exit critical locations that either are experiencing dramatic erosion now or will in the future. And it's more than just beach nourishment. It's perhaps the state offering state lands for land swaps. Perhaps it is a buyout program where a homeowner whose house is about to be undermined, that home is no longer worth $6 million, right? It's about to collapse into the ocean. But maybe there could be some funding provided to make that
so they could relocate.
So that they could relocate or at least exit that property without a complete loss.
You talk about critical areas. Can you name a few of those critical areas?
Well, sure. Portions of Sunset. 3 years ago, there were sections around Rocky Point where literally homes were just feet from collapsing onto the beach. And in fact, a swimming pool did collapse onto the beach and certain other features. So that was a temporary thing related to a particular wave event. But it also sort of puts an exclamation point on the fact that it's likely to happen again.
All right. We've got lots of callers on the line. They want to all talk to you. We're going to go now to Christopher, also calling from the Big Island. Aloha, Christopher. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I would just like to ask the engineers if they can remember back when they were children building sandcastles below the high tide line. And how many times they were successful in maintaining their structures, because this is a massive thing. The ocean sea level is rising. You're dreaming if you think you're going to stop this. If we're going to engineer our way out of this, it's just not going to happen. You can build revetment walls and groins and things like this, but the ocean is going to flood all around it and come in from behind and from the sides. It's going to undermine the bedrock and the gravel. It's just going to – you can't stop this ocean. It's just massive.
All right. Let me see if I can get you an answer to that, because he's saying, look, ocean movement is inevitable. Things happen. People choose to put their houses in places where they shouldn't be. Even in California, building all of Pacific Coast Highway in areas that are known to be geologically unstable, lots of movement around there, looking what's happening around the island. So what are you going to do? Are these efforts to mitigate the movement really going to be effective, or as Christopher saying, are we really dreaming? Brad?
To the caller's point, it's a good point. There really is no fighting water. Sea levels get high enough. Even the best-built seawall is not going to be effective, and we're experiencing that now. We have numerous seawalls failing. Again, the West Maui area really comes to mind. The county planning department is inundated with requests to repair old failing seawalls that are getting undermined and overtopped, and where water is getting into yards and affecting buildings along these areas, particularly where the beach has been lost.
All right, we're going to go now to Susan calling from Kahului. Susan, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I think you wanted to know about any research or studies going on around Kualoa Beach Park specifically.
Well, yes, I called to ask about Kualoa Beach Park because the erosion is so dramatic there over the last 30 years. But I'm also wondering if anyone on the panel knows whether the state government and downtown companies are developing backup plans for when the sea level rise starts to hit downtown.
All right. Well, two-part question. Chip, take at least the first part.
So Kualoa has been eroding for decades. I think the city is doing the right thing in the sense that they are trying to get out of the way. This brings up the bigger point that was made earlier, but I want to emphasize you can't fix this problem. You can't stop this problem. This problem has to be managed. And if your management decision is, let's put up a wall, there are certain costs and benefits to that. If your management decision is, let's just get out of the way and let the erosion happen, there are certain costs and benefits to that. If your management decision is, let's nourish the beach with sand, again, there are pros and cons. A lot of that is driven by the cost-benefit ratio. Sometimes it's driven solely by environmental and ecosystem considerations. So we could go beach by beach around the state and discuss why the erosion is happening and what are the solutions, but solutions is really the wrong word. It's choices. What are we going to choose to do here?
And that's a very different perspective than what most people come up with. They see a problem, they want a solution.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have a fix. And hopefully one that's not going to cost too much and one that will happen very quickly.
Yeah.
And the point that all of you have been making consistently, both on and off this program, is that this is not the situation. And we have to change our mindset about how we approach these beaches and look at management and look at it as being an ongoing maintenance issue.
So that's right, a maintenance issue. To the caller's second point, prior to Western contact, Kaka'ako was a salt-gathering location. And today, the restaurant called Salt sort of celebrates that idea. The fact that it was a salt-gathering location means that it lay below high tide. Ocean water would sweep in there and then evaporate. We raised Kaka'ako and most of Waikiki roughly 2 feet by dredging the Alawai, dredging reef areas around Ala Moana Beach Park and Kualoa Basin and Honolulu Harbor. And so we are really, in those areas, only 2 feet away from being inundated by the rising ocean. And it turns out that the water table underneath the land sits not at mean sea level, but above mean sea level in these areas. And that water table goes up and down with the tides, meaning that the water table is connected to the ocean. And as the ocean rises, so will the water table. This is called groundwater inundation. And when the groundwater table inundates the land surface, breaks out on the land surface, that's what a wetland is. So we're looking at these areas eventually becoming wetlands. This is already happening in South Florida. Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and other regions are experiencing this already.
All right. Thanks very much, Susan, for both of your questions. Going to go now to Ted calling us from Manoa, wanting to talk about some of the issues concerning reefs and preventing erosion.
Yes, I believe that if we lose the reefs, If we lose the reefs, we're going to lose the beaches at a time when reefs are stressed worldwide by global warming, and I think here locally by factors such as sewage and overfishing and even chemical sunscreens. Are there things we can do to help our local reefs survive?
All right.
So
a study recently
came out that looked at reefs over the last 28 years and found that the rate of bleaching of these reefs around the world has tripled. So the rate of global bleaching of reefs has tripled in the last 28 years. And they projected that by 2050, 98% of the reefs of the world will be experiencing annual bleaching. Annual bleaching eventually kills a reef, and we've already seen in the northern portion of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia 3 years of strong bleaching. And the latest word from the scientists there is that it's no longer a matter of the reef being bleached. It's a matter of the reef having been dead now for 15 months and literally collapsing as a structure, as a geologic structure, under the attack of the waves. So what can we do to help reefs survive the problems associated with global warming and ocean acidification is to remove all the anthropogenic stressors, the human-made stressors, such as the caller lists, the pollution coming out of our watersheds and the sunscreens, relieve those types of stressors against the reef and give it every chance it can to combat the problem of lowering the pH of the ocean because it's dissolving CO2 from the atmosphere and the extreme warming that is taking place.
Bottom line, we need to do what we can do and not just keep talking about the problems.
We need to let these ecosystems adapt to global warming. And so if we can remove the negative impacts we already have on them, they'll be that much better for it.
All right. We're going to go now to Jim calling us from Waimanalo. Aloha, Jim. You wanted to know about whether or not the king tides have had a noteworthy impact on erosion.
No, not exactly. Actually, I got to say, since you brought it up, I've been a city and county lifeguard for 31 years, and all us lifeguards are a little tired of the king tides term because I've never once in my life heard that before. But my question is, I came across an article about 6 weeks ago that said that Hawaii's tides are averaging about 8 to 10 inches higher than normal, and regardless of where we are on the moon cycle. And I've witnessed this at the beach several times, and I'm just wondering if the guys have any knowledge of this, comments on it, or what the history is on this.
All right, Jim, thanks very much and for the clarification. Brad, can you take that one?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So the king tides term is just a catchy phrase for the highest tides that we experience every year from the sun and moon. So that's not unusual. We're coming in the time of year this summer, particularly coming up end of next week, and then again in July when we experience the highest tides of the year. What is unusual at the moment is that we're seeing some additional elevated water levels on top of that, adding on top of those predicted high tides. This appears to be due to some ocean-wide variability due to some multi-decadal changes referred to as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, possibly also related to some lingering effects from the El Niños we experienced the last couple of years. We also get some variability from these eddies, these rotating masses of water that move through the islands that can raise sea level by several inches. And then there's also global sea level. We've seen 6-8 inches of sea level rise at least from our tide gauges around Hawaii. So that's a component of it as well. And what we've experienced this summer, what we continue to experience and expect through the rest of summer is that is this unusual situation where we have these additive components of elevated water level on top of the predicted lunar tides.
So the caller is correct what he read. It has been on the order of 6 to 10 inches higher than the predicted tide all year long. And with regard to the term king tide, it's a new term used in the United States and in Hawaii. It's borrowed from the Australians and even the New Zealanders who've been using that term for a long time. It's worked its way across the Pacific, and I've heard king tides now being used in Florida and South Carolina. So it's just a new term that's making its way around the world.
Thank you both. Dolan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to this the topic of king tides. We've been closely monitoring this. There's a whole army of volunteers that have been going out taking photos of the king tides this summer and for the last two summers.
And they're floating, right?
Yeah, and you can upload it. You can visit PacificIslandsKingTides.org and sign up to help us understand this phenomena and document what's happening. But it's also, we heard from Jim, the lifeguard, it's a glimpse into our near future when we see these elevated water levels of, on the order of, 8, 10 inches. That's what our near future is going to look like. And it's really important that we understand those areas that are most vulnerable. We saw a lot of inundation in Waikiki Beach during that last king tide. We're expecting another one coming up next week. So we're putting out forecasts, letting people know it's coming. Is it the end of the world? No, but we need to pay attention to it and start to think about how we might prepare for it in the future.
All right, we're going to take a few more callers. If you want to join us, 941-3689 from Oahu and from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Going to Gus, calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Gus, and thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon, gang. Thanks for doing what you're doing. Hey, we should have a 12-year plan. We should declare a natural disaster, do everything the proactive thing that you folks have been doing. It's not going to get better. We got to have, like, a schemata of what it's going to look like. We can do that with our computers. And then we're going to have to, you know, tell people that's what's going to happen. Or everything's going to be affected. I mean, this is an army base, a military base, so they're going to have to, like, do everything.
Well, Gus, I don't think you're getting a whole lot of counter-argument from the people around the table, because they've been trying to make that point for a very, very long time, and they're probably very happy that you agree. Going now to Richard, calling us from the North Shore. Aloha, Richard. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. I live near Waimea Bay, and I heard that there's a lava tube under the road that's connecting the river water to the beach water, and it would explain why the water's been dirty out there a lot in the past year, even when it hasn't rained. I wonder if you've heard of that.
All right, anybody want to take that one on?
Yeah, well, I used to be a lifeguard on the North Shore.
All right, you're
in
listening
a
to
former
Dolan.
Lifetime. There are a lot of lava tubes in that area, the Waimea Point. It does present an opportunity for water to discharge kind of directly into the ocean without it going overland. I'm not familiar of one particular lava tube that would be coming out of the valley, but we did see a lot of erosion of upland last summer, heavy rainfall, and there's a lot of that sediment and suspended sediment stuck in the water column. It settles on the bottom. Every time we get waves, it stirs it up. So that could be the phenomena that you're observing.
There is submarine groundwater discharge, and I'll never forget a few years ago, I was flying past Molokai to Maui, and it was raining cats and dogs, and there were these huge silt plumes coming up in the middle of the channel between Molokai and Lanai. And it must have been silt coming down off of Molokai through a lava tube or something and literally springing up through the seafloor. It was the strangest thing. So the caller's onto something potentially real there.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Going now to Nathaniel, calling us from Maui.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, I'm calling to find out. Everybody's talking about correcting this erosion, and all everybody's doing is thinking about the tourists. What about stopping all this building on our beaches, which are causing a major erosion? That's what I think it is.
All right. Well, we want to have Brad answer you. Brad Ramon, go ahead.
So the real challenge is dealing with the existing development. But Maui and Kauai counties in particular are trying to address these issues in future development. They have increased the building setbacks on the islands. They actually use the erosion rates that come that were sponsored by the counties, done by CHIPS Research Group. I was involved in some of those. They use the erosion rates from these mapping projects and determine the setback from the shoreline based off of those rates to try to move homes and roads and new development out of the hazard area.
Thanks very much for the call. We also had a shy caller while we were all talking a little bit, saying that New York Times reported about efforts underway in Holland. Are any of these solutions elsewhere? Are there solutions elsewhere that Hawaii might make use of? I mean, we like to think about ourselves as being a very singular place, but
we certainly stay in touch with the research going on around the world. And the community of coastal engineers and coastal geologists and coastal planners is a relatively small community. It's important for all of us to attend meetings and to communicate with each other, and that certainly is done.
So what is it that you think that we might be making use of that might be happening elsewhere, or is there something?
Well, we're trying to build on the best practices when it comes to beach nourishment. We're trying to build on industry best practices with regard to building things like groins, the new T-head groin at the Royal Hawaiian that was approved recently by the Board of Land and Natural Resources is a product of a industry standard, a best practice that the coastal engineering community has developed. And we also try and take advantage of best practices and standards with regard to managing development in the coastal zone. It's so difficult to control coastal development when there's private land ownership. And so there are very few jurisdictions that value private land ownership that are making great headway in retreating from the rising sea. It's a very thorny problem.
You've all mentioned best practices and the fact that there have been mistakes in past. Best practices usually come out of a lot of the lessons that you learn when you've had some things that have not gone as one would have hoped, or even not had the kind of real study behind them. You mentioned some of those earlier in the program, Dolan. We're coming to the last part of the program now, but as you look out at some of the really problematic hotspots that each of you have touched on a little bit, what do you think are some of the best lessons that we may have learned from other hotspots that shouldn't be repeated, that we should all be a little bit more sensitive toward as some of these mitigations are coming into play, and in understanding that these are mitigations, not fixes?
I'd like to address that with maybe a concluding comment, that one of the things that gives me hope is we mentioned early in the program that we have a lot of information available to us. We're at that stage now of trying to ask ourselves as a community, what do we do with this information? How do we apply it, for setbacks and building codes, things like that? But one of the other things I'm encouraged to see more recently now is the formation of community groups. In the case of Waikiki, we have a commercially focused group, the Waikiki Beach Special Improvement District. They represent the hotel interests in Waikiki. But they, in addition, there's the Kaanapali Operators Association. We're starting to see these commercially oriented groups pool their resources, pool their interests. And that provides an opportunity to create partnerships with the state. So it's not just the state's problem. It's not just a private landowner problem. It's a community-led problem. And we can find ways to develop innovative solutions when we pool our assets.
Brad?
Not sure what to add to that. That's a good point, Dolan.
All right. Well, you don't have to add to that if you don't want to add to that. It's just the point is that getting our minds around this in a very different way than most people want to is tough. Yes. And so I'll give you some of the final words on that. We got a couple of minutes left in the program, and you can jump back in, Brad, if you want to as well. But Chip Fletcher, as we look not just at Waikiki, Kaanapali, other places around the state where there are issues of beach erosion, what are some of the lessons you think we all have to get our minds around in being able to do it better the next time around, and perhaps the next time around and all that, because this is maintenance?
Well, Beth Ann, I think one of the most important things is what's going on right now, public education. So kudos to you as a media representative bringing this issue before the public. I think we need to see more media involvement, perhaps in the form of public service announcements, which deal not just with beach management, but also with the wider problem of climate change. Sea level rise is not going away. In fact, it's going to accelerate, and every new bit of research that comes out of Antarctica or Greenland or the expansion of the world's oceans because they're getting warmer takes us into more and more extreme levels of sea level rise potentially occurring later on this century. We're at the very beginning of a difficult slow-motion collision, as I said at the start, where our coastal communities have to decide how are we going to manage this problem of sea level rise.
Well, I want to thank you very much for this conversation. We will have others. Chip Fletcher, Dolan Eversole, and Brad Remine, thank you both. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, too, for your calls. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for the conversation. Meantime, have yourselves a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.